Kingsburger meeting. So tonight we have a real treat. We have Michelle from Kingsburg with a little over 8 years of sobriety. So I asked her what the secret to sobriety is for her, and she said, ha, it is no secret, it's in the book. So I was like, oh, okay, fine, I see. And then, but she did say that serenity and sobriety comes from what she's learned in the program. And the word serenity really stuck out to me, and I asked her to kind of define that. What does that mean to her? What does that look like? What does that feel like? And she said, serenity feels quiet in my head. And I don't know about you guys, but when I'm in my addiction and or in depression or whatever else, my thoughts are going a million miles an hour and they're loud. And so she's talking about that peace, that quiet that comes with serenity, that comes with this program when you work the steps. I asked her how being of service contributes to her sobriety. She said it keeps me busy. Gives me a purpose and a schedule with structure. Michelle is a part of Tuffy Paw, which is Tulare United Fresno Young Peoples of Alcoholics Anonymous. She is the service liaison of Northern California. She's also the intergroup rep for Kingsburg Fellowship, and she has 3 sponsees. I've asked her if she'd had any struggles during the eight-year course of her recovery, and she nodded, and she's like, yes, like, duh. She said jobs, relationships. She's been married and divorced, thinking that she could live a life without the program and then kind of burning things down the way she did when she was in her addiction. I also asked her if she had any advice for the newcomer, so the newcomer that walks in the door terrified, not knowing what to do. And she said, oh, you know, like I remember being a newcomer and that she felt like she needed to give herself a chance. She felt like she needed to give herself a better life. So she encourages the newcomer to give yourself that chance. Don't be so hard on yourself. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce our speaker for the night, Michelle from Kingsburg.
Hi, everybody. Obviously, my name is Michelle, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow. It's nice to be here. When I was asked to do this speaker meeting about, I don't know, I think it's been about 4 or 5 months ago, I was asked to do this. I felt pretty honored, you know, for somebody to come up to me after a meeting of just a short time of sharing some of my experience and ask me to do a speaker meeting this big. It made me feel pretty good. You know, Sonia mentioned that I have a little over 8 years of sobriety, but I still have, you know, those thoughts like I'm not good enough, I'll never be able to measure up, you know, those things still come up. And for an alcoholic like me, sometimes it's hard to believe that I could be looked at as somebody who can contribute to life, because for so long I felt like I wasn't able to do that. I felt like I couldn't give anything, and I really wanted to, I just didn't know how. You know, I remember when I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it wasn't because I wanted to be here. It was because I was living in a homeless shelter for women veterans. I served some time in the military, so I was able to get some benefits back from that. Going through a treatment facility, living in this shelter for homeless women veterans, and I had no idea that I was an alcoholic. You know, I knew that there was a problem, and I just didn't know what the problem was, and I didn't know how to go about solving it, because everything I had tried did not work. For the last few years of my drinking and using career, I didn't drink a whole lot. So when I walked into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't think I was going to be able to relate to anybody. because I was using other substances, because by that time the alcohol had stopped working. But when I came into my first meeting, I walked in with another woman that was living in this homeless shelter with me, because she didn't want to go alone and she was court ordered to go, and I had nothing better to do. So I came in and I started hearing people talk about the way that I felt and the things that I had done and the things that were going through my head. And at that moment, I realized that I wasn't alone, because for so many years, I felt like I was alone. I felt like I was the only one who felt like I wasn't good enough. I felt like, life was so impossible. I didn't know how to live it, and I thought there was something seriously wrong with me. And I thought I was the only one like that. So when I heard other people talking about that, it just kind of blew my mind. I had kept myself isolated for so many years, thinking that, you know, there was no hope for me. And once I started hearing people, you know, express these things that I was thinking, I was pretty amazed. So that first meeting, I don't know what everybody said, but I know they said something that caught my attention. And thank God that I was able to have an open mind and open ears enough to be able to hear it, because I would not be here today. And I don't mean that in the literal sense, like right here. I mean here in general. I probably would have ended my life a long time ago. I remember right at the end of that meeting, they called on me to share, because they knew I was a newcomer. It was pretty obvious. And I couldn't even get out the words, "My name is Michelle," before I started crying. It was a complete disaster. But that's all it took for people to notice that I needed help. And after that meeting, you know, there were several women who came up to me and introduced themselves to me, and I can't remember all of them, but it meant a lot to me that they took the time to do that, that they extended their hand to me and introduced themselves and gave me their phone number. At the time, I didn't have a phone, but it was still nice to get phone numbers. And that was when I realized that there was something. There was something worth living for. I still didn't quite know what it was. I was clean and sober at the time, but at that time the only reason I was because I couldn't live in the place I was living in, and I couldn't go to the outpatient program that I was going to unless I was clean and sober. So I stayed that way to be able to do that. And in my head, I thought that, you know, after all this time, I can go ahead and have a drink, you know. Because in my head, I wasn't an alcoholic. I was a drug addict at the time. That's how I identified myself. That's exactly what I thought I was. And being addicted to, you name it, whatever it was that made me feel better, that got me out of my head, that made me forget who I was, that's what I liked doing. Once I started hearing people talk about what it actually meant to be an alcoholic, I started relating and identifying with that. Because when I was drinking, I had plenty of people tell me that I had a problem, that I was an alcoholic, but I never had anybody explain to me what that meant. They just told me how much of a piece of crap I was, and how I was doing this wrong and that wrong, and, you know, questioning how come I drink so much, why can't you just drink a little bit, why can't you not drink tonight? You know, I had no real answers to those questions, and I never knew that I was an alcoholic. When I finally got the courage to ask somebody to help me in this program, to help me figure out what the problem was, you know, she took me through this book, and it really caught my attention in the doctor's opinion, where he talks about our twofold illness, the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. And I started understanding what that meant. Because when I first started drinking, I was about 15 years old, and I remember I drank blackberry brandy and Sprite. And when I was growing up, drinking was normal. It was just what everybody did in my family. So, it was nothing that, it didn't seem like it was wrong, you know? So I remember, you know, mixing the drink and taking that drink. And when that alcohol hit me, I could feel it. You know, I had the drink up to my lips and I could feel the warmth just going down my throat and going into my stomach. And it was like it lit me on fire. And I felt like this is what I have been looking for my whole life, you know, even though I was only 15. But, and then once that kicked in, all the fear and the anxiety and the not, you know, feeling not good enough, all of that disappeared. And I knew that this is exactly how I wanted to feel for the rest of my life, because I had no worries at that moment in time. However, I did not stop there. I believe that from the very beginning, I was alcoholic. I just didn't know it at the time. Because I remember that night, pieces of that night, and I remember drinking, and I remember feeling that good feeling, but I kept on drinking. And I was at home in Kingsburg, sitting outside next to my stepmom, and we were talking, and I leaned over, and I threw up, and I just looked back at her, and I took another drink, and she looks at me, and she goes, "You feel better now?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." And I kept on drinking. Now, a normal person would have been like, "Hell no, that was disgusting. I'm not going to drink anymore." No, that wasn't me. I drank that, you know, however long it took that night for me to just absolutely pass out. I drank to oblivion that first time. And then I woke up the next day out in the yard. And and I remember thinking, "Man, I feel like shit. I can't wait to do that again." What normal person thinks that? You know, I have a sister. You know, we both have the same mother and father. She's not alcoholic. She drinks a couple of drinks and she is just fine. She's like, "Oh, nope, I'm good." I do not understand that concept. I have never been able to drink a couple of drinks and be like, "Oh, I've had enough. I'm good." No. I drink a couple of drinks and I'm wondering where that next drink is going to come from and how quickly I can get it into my body. And it made me feel so good, and that was the feeling I wanted to hold on to for the rest of my life. And it worked for a little while. So I didn't drink every day after that happened, but I definitely drank as often as I could, and still was kind of able to maintain, but I was constantly thinking about that drink. I remember in high school, you know, I would go home at lunchtime and have a couple beers and then convince my stepmom that I didn't need to go back to school because there was nothing important going on, and I'd stay home and keep on drinking. I was never forced to go to school. It's kind of funny. I was raised on a 30-acre vineyard, and I worked my ass off with our family, but it was okay for me to drink and do drugs as long as I got decent grades in school and I still did my chores. So again, it was a normal thing. But, you know, as time went on, the obsession was always there, and I never understood why I couldn't stop drinking once I started to drink. After high school, I joined the Navy, and I made this life-changing decision to join the Navy because I didn't want to go to college. I felt like if I were to pay or, you know, earn money to go to school, that I would just screw it all up because I wanted to party. So I decided that, you know, the greatest idea ever was to join the Navy so they could pay me to drink. Best idea ever. So here I am, 19 years old. I get stationed in South Texas, and a month later, I was on a ship. A month later, we go on a deployment, and I'm going to Spain, France, and Italy, and they don't care how old I am to drink. I was in heaven. I think the only time until I got sober, the only time I went without a drink for a long period of time was when I was in boot camp and I was forced to go that long. And when I got to the ship and we were going from the Gulf of Mexico to Spain, and that was 2 weeks, I almost died. It was horrible going that long without alcohol. So I got another brilliant idea, and I learned how to sneak it onto the ship. I would literally look and see who was like on the watch bill. You know, if my friend was on quarterdeck watch, that's when I knew it was the perfect time to bring the alcohol on board. So I would plan my day around that. I wouldn't go and see all these amazing things in Spain and France and Italy. No, it was all about how I could get the drink. And I'm so surprised I got an honorable discharge out of the military because I got into trouble a lot. But most of it, you know, it was just a slap on the hand and people laughing it off. That I was totally enabled when I was in the Navy. It was a normal thing to drink. So on the second deployment in 2001, we were supposed to go to all these other countries and on the other side of the world. So Thailand, Singapore, Japan, Guam, Hawaii, and I told myself, I said, this time I'm going to see the world. I'm actually going to be, you know, a participant in doing things. Oh, I tried. I tried so hard to do that, but it just didn't work because the first thing I did was get off that ship and find a bar. And so did everybody else. But other people were doing different things too. It had just become so much of an obsession that I couldn't do the normal things that other people did. You know, I was getting brought back to the ship by shore patrol. I was getting thrown in the brig because, you know, just doing things that were a disgrace to Americans. You know, I would have these other people in these other countries just laughing at me because I'm throwing up on the street in their country, you know, and you would think that something like that would kind of slow me down or make me realize what was going on, but it didn't. And you know, all this time, I can't have a proper relationship with anybody. You know, I'm constantly letting down my coworkers. You know, I go to sleep, I find some place to sleep, and they're having to pick up my slack. You know, it's just, it's a constant thing. And those kind of things went on for years. After I got out of the Navy, I had gotten a job at a refinery in South Texas, and normal to drink there too. So I was working with a bunch of guys, and you know, it was shift work. I'd get off work at 5:20 in the morning, and I'd be drunk by 5:40, you know, but I didn't stop there. I would have an ice chest packed in the back of my truck, because everybody in Texas has a truck, you know. And as soon as I got off work, I'd take 5 or 6 beers out of the ice chest and bring them into the front of the truck with me and drink them before I got home. And I only had like a 10-minute drive home. And when I got home, there was, you know, I didn't stop there. I just kept on drinking until I passed out. And I'd wake up and all these crazy places, and I don't know how it happened, but it did every single time. And when people would, you know, want to go out and have fun, I'd be like, okay, this time it's not going to happen that way. This time I'm going to eat a really big meal and I won't pass out. This time I'm going to just start drinking beer and, you know, it's not going to end up the way it did before. But no matter what I tried, the end result was always the same. And I always drank to oblivion and then woke up later wondering how the hell it had happened again. When people started talking about the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body, I was like, oh my God, that's what's wrong with me. Because I couldn't figure it out for so many years because other people around me were drinking like normal people. And so that's what got me to identify as an alcoholic. Because I realized that for all those years, there was nothing I could think about but drinking. And then once I got that alcohol into my system, I couldn't stop until I passed out. And in the doctor's opinion, you know, it goes along, it keeps on, and it talks about how, you know, we've basically passed this imaginary line where we can't go back, you know. And unless a total psychic change has occurred, then there's really no hope for us. And I didn't quite understand that at first. You see, I'm not a religious person, and the main reason I stayed away from Alcoholics Anonymous for the first 90 days I was sober was because of God. I saw the word God in the steps, and I said, nope, I don't want any part of that. Because in my opinion, for so many years, God was the one who led me astray. God was the one who let me down. God was the one who took these important people away from me. When I was younger, my mom died and my dad died. And so I had built up this resentment against God, thinking that I wasn't good enough and that, you know, he was punishing me, so to speak. So, when people started talking about what it means to have that psychic change, you know, the spiritual experience that it talks about in the back of our book, excuse me, it doesn't mean that I have to, you know, that I have to join a cult or that I have to believe what everybody else believes or what this or that person believes. It just means that I had to come in with an open mind and be willing to listen to what other people have experienced and how they got where they are today, and basically lay aside a bunch of my ideas and my beliefs and believe that this is going to work for me because it worked for you. And that's what got me through it for a while, because I saw that it worked for you guys, and that's what I wanted. I wanted something to work for me. And it says in here, it says, the term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. So that's what I needed. I needed a personality change. I needed what was going on up here to be different than what it was. I had to have something different because everything that I was doing wasn't working and I couldn't figure out why. The way that that happened for me was getting into the step work, getting into the book, finding somebody who could help me, finding somebody who not necessarily I could identify with or relate to, but somebody who could help me through what I had no idea what I was doing. And help me figure out what was going on up here, because I couldn't do it on my own. It was like a foreign language up in my head that I didn't understand. So the process of the steps is what worked for me. I needed a higher power. I needed some other power that wasn't in me to give me that mental defense against the obsession that I was talking about. So I don't pick up the drink. You know, I could never fight that thought in my head with the thoughts in my head. Every time I tried to talk myself into doing it differently, it just, you know, it was always the same old thing. I don't ever remember telling myself I'm not going to drink again. I was the alcoholic who always thought I could figure it all out, who could beat the game, who could, you know, find that loophole and be okay drinking like I did. But I was never able to find that. And that power that I needed to fight that obsession, I didn't know how to find that either. And when I found a sponsor that could take me through the steps, and the steps are in order the way that they are for a reason, because I believe that each step brings you to the next step, and you're ready for the next step when you get there. So once I learned about the powerlessness, what that really meant, and the unmanageability of my life, which in the beginning was much smaller than what I found out through the process of the steps. Then it was time to move on to, you know, believe that there is a power greater than myself that can restore me from, you know, from this crazy thinking that I have. Because after looking back and really examining these thoughts that I had, what kind of sane thinking is it? You know, I have no evidence in my past that shows me I can safely drink. But yet, just before I pick up that drink, I have a thought in my head that I can. And it's always something different. And it's always something just spectacular that makes it okay to pick up that drink. But yet, you know, you talk to a normal person and they look at you like you're crazy. Because they see what you're going through, and they're like, don't you realize that every time you pick up that drink that this or that happens? Well, no, I don't realize it, because I can't recall those kind of memories. I just recall the good stuff. There's a part in our book from the chapter "There Is a Solution," and it says, "The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink." I was definitely without defense. I couldn't even bring into my memory the suffering and humiliation of hours ago. That's how bad it was for me. I needed a defense to keep me from picking up that drink. And through the process of the steps, I found that defense. You know, once I got to step three, I didn't know how to turn my will and my life over to the power of God. For one thing, I really didn't understand God at the time. But what made it easier for me was just whatever understanding I had was good enough. And what also made it easy for me is that if I really thought about my will and my life and how far I had gotten in the craziness that I thought was okay, anything was better than what I had. And so in order for me to really see the truth of all that and how I had gotten myself in such a mess, I had to right away move on to step four and look at that. You know, look at my past and see how my actions and my thoughts made my life unmanageable. It wasn't the drinking and the drugs. It was this that made my life unmanageable. And it was the hole inside of me that I couldn't fill with anything I tried, with the alcohol, with the drugs, with the jobs, with the money, with the relationships, you know, you name it. I tried, and nothing filled that hole. So being able to look back and see the truth of all my actions and my thoughts, the way I treated people, how my life was ruled by fear. And I had no idea that my life was ruled by fear until I got into that fourth step. And I saw how almost every decision I made in my life was because I was afraid of something. Either I was afraid of not getting what I wanted, I was afraid of losing what I already had, I was afraid of what people thought of me, I was afraid of what I thought you thought of me. I mean, you name it, there was all fear. Everything was a fear, and I had no idea. So once I was able to see that, and I could not see it on my own. I needed the help of a sponsor. I needed the help of somebody who could help me see it from another perspective, because I can only see it from my perspective at that point. So once I'm able to find somebody who can help me see it for the truth and not use my delusional thinking, then I know where I've gone wrong. So then it makes it a little bit easier to move into step 6 and 7, because once I see all these chaotic things and all this, all my thinking and all my actions and how screwed up it is, yeah, you're right. I want to get rid of all that, because look what it's done. Look what it's done to not only me, but to other people in my life, other people that really loved me and wanted to help me. And all I did was push them away. So by this point, yeah, I'm ready to get rid of those character defects the best that I can. Now, don't get me wrong. Life is not perfect, and I am not perfect. I am far from perfect. But being able to see those flaws, I can identify them a lot quicker now, and I don't burn bridges like I used to. My thinking is changing by this point, because I don't want to be that person that I saw on paper anymore. I want to be a better person, and I've always wanted to be a better person. I just didn't know how, because I was so full of fear, self-centeredness, selfishness, self-pity. I probably threw the biggest pity parties that anybody could think of for myself. So once I see how all these things are just destroying everything around me, I have to believe that there's something better. You know, I can work towards something better, and I can't do that on my own. I need help. I need prayer. I need guidance from other people who have been able to go through all that and come out on the other side okay. It was mentioned that I had a period of my sobriety. I call it my dry time, because everything was going really good for me. After about a year of sobriety, I got a job, I got a car, I got a place to live, I got a dog, I got into a relationship, I got married, and was starting a little family, and things were looking good from the outside. If you were to see my life at that time from the outside, you would have thought I was doing incredible. But on the inside, I wasn't. I was missing something, and I didn't know what it was. And after years of living like that, all I could think of was drinking again. And I had frequent thoughts of walking over to the liquor store or to the corner store or wherever to get that relief that I was looking for. And the more frequent those thoughts came to me, the more it scared me, because I had learned enough in Alcoholics Anonymous the first time to know that I wasn't going to be able to fight those thoughts for very long. And one night it had gotten so bad that I don't know what it was, what made me do it, but I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous instead of walking into a liquor store. And I'm very grateful for that. And I knew exactly what I needed to do. I needed to find a sponsor. So the third meeting I went to, I found a sponsor, and I asked her to help me. And I'm so grateful for that, too, because she was able to take me through the process of the steps in a lot more in-depth than I had ever done before. She was able to show me a lot of things that I wasn't able to see. And because of that, I can live a much better quality of life now. You know, the ups and downs that I faced, obviously that marriage that I had ended, you know, I went through a divorce. I wouldn't have been able to get through that without Alcoholics Anonymous, without the support system that I had. I just kept on coming to meetings and doing, you know, what it is that needs to be done in this program to keep me okay up here. Because when I'm not okay up here, I think it's all right to drink. And, you know, I moved back to California a little over a year ago, and my life has never been better. I have a really good job. I work for the United States Postal Service, which is absolutely amazing for an alcoholic like me. I live back at home with my family, and that is okay. You know, I'm 40 years old and I still live at home, but I'm okay with that. I am happier than I've ever been, and I hardly have anything. I'm single. I have 3 dogs, and my dogs are like the light of my life. I can't wait to get home every day to see my dogs. I know that sounds, doesn't that sound pathetic? Anyway, you know, it's the simple things in life that I really appreciate, and right now I'm just very grateful for the life that I have today, and I owe it all to Alcoholics Anonymous. So thanks for listening to me. That's all I have.